Welcome to the Libertarian Alliance podcast. The date is the 28th of July, 2015. We haven't had a podcast for some time. This podcast won't actually be a discussion program. It will be me reading a chapter from my book. The book is called Liberty from a Beginner. It's very cheap on Amazon. It's only on the Kindle. It's received some very nice reviews from people like Sean Gabb and Keith Preston. So I do encourage you to buy it, if only because the money will go to me. And the chapter that I'll be reading is A Libertarian Case Against Mass Immigration. The consensus among modern libertarians seems to be that free immigration is the only libertarian stance possible in this immigration debate, because of the economic benefits, and that those who oppose free immigration are just statists who want the government to control who can and can't move about from here to there. Conversely, it's my own opinion that a state policy of open borders amounts to an infringement of private property rights, and that consequently border controls tighter than those currently in force are perfectly compatible with libertarian legal theory. I think the way to summarise UKIP's stance on the topic in question is an end to state-sponsored multiculturalism and allowing people to enter the country only through a selective Australian-style points system. Those libertarians who consider themselves cosmopolitan and tolerant may cry far-right or racist at such policies, but I wholeheartedly support them as a step in the right direction. Hans Hermann Hoppe, the great libertarian economist and philosopher, did advocate something similar to UKIP policy in his 1999 article on the subject, which was, quote, requiring an existing employment contract with a resident citizen, end quote, for any immigrant. It doesn't help the libertarian movement in the UK when libertarians like Sam Bowman of the Adam Smith Institute write such things as, quote, immigrants bring new skills to the country, allow for more specialisation, tend to be more entrepreneurial than average, pay more into the welfare state than they take out, and make things cheaper by doing the jobs that Britons won't, end quote. And consider this to be an argument for open borders. Well, this is true, yet Bowman is arguing only from an economist's viewpoint, with no discussion of rights. Yes, real incomes may well increase as a result of mass immigration, but the answer to the immigration question is not that simple. As libertarians, we must take into account the rights of individuals, property rights. Indeed, Hoppe, a sound Austrian economist himself, acknowledged all of the arguments made by Bowman and more. Quote, the classical argument in favour of free immigration runs as follows. Other things being equal, businesses go to low-wage areas and labour moves to high-wage areas, thus affecting a tendency towards the equalisation of wage rates for the same kind of labour, as well as the optimal localisation of capital. An influx of migrants into a given-sized high-wage area will lower nominal wage rates. However, it will not lower real wage rates if the population is below its optimal size. To the contrary, if this is the case, the produced output will increase over proportionally and real incomes will actually rise. End quote. However, Hoppe does not consider this to be the now and forever true definitive argument for open borders. Hoppe was the libertarian who helped change my mind on immigration, and he doesn't support a policy of mass immigration despite acknowledging these very sound economic arguments. In fact, he calls for a return to the time when monarchs would take it upon themselves to take out the human trash, and argues a case for a return of rather more closed borders. For the remainder I will attempt to explain my position in terms of property rights and in terms of justice, rather than the laws of economics. So, ignore governments for a minute, abandon any thoughts of a state existing, and forget any such talk of an immigration policy. Let's talk purely and simply about our rights to move within this free society. For example, do I have a right to move onto my neighbour's property without his consent? Furthermore, even if we call it migration, do I have a right to burgle a house? All rights we have stem from our rights to the property that we have acquired or have been granted use of, and thus it's plain wrong to talk of any rights to move onto anyone else's property without negating the concept of exclusive rights to property itself. Even if, while I break into your house and steal your television, I empty my wallet onto your couch to compensate for the robbery before I quietly leave, it can't be said that I ever did have a right to enter into the house in the first place. But the state blurs the issue beyond recognition. Firstly, we are so used to and comfortable with the idea of an immigration policy, that is, merely the state's interference in the movement of people from one person's property to another. And secondly, the state has acquired property which it calls its own. Now, to be sure, no consistent libertarian can think of state property as anything other than an oxymoron. The state has no just property, and all that it possesses belongs to its original appropriator or his heirs. And there are only two ways in which an immigration policy can unfold. Either it becomes forced integration, or it becomes forced segregation. Accordingly, then, we must choose between the lesser of the two evils. Forced integration can be viewed as nothing less than the state allowing burglars into one's home. Nobody but the state gave the immigrants permission to enter its property. As the state has decided to assume control of the borders and most of the infrastructure, we must view the state as a caretaker owner or a director of a company appointed by the shareholders. As the state immigration policy grants immigrants theoretical use of all public property in all four corners of the United Kingdom, as the only immigration policy we have is set for the entire United Kingdom, anything less than a total consensus on free immigration from the domestic taxpayers is unsatisfactory, as property rights cannot be violated, not even by majority consent. It's because of the centralised nature of our immigration policy that it can only result in either forced integration or forced segregation. The domestic taxpaying population of Notting Hill, who must be regarded as the owners of the public property in Notting Hill, might all unanimously agree to officially invite an unlimited number of foreigners to Notting Hill to settle. But I think this would be unlikely even in such a cosmopolitan area as that. It's because the state has expropriated all that it claims to own, and has further expropriated the funds with which to build and repair its property, that the state cannot legitimately be seen to be the owner of the roads, the owner of the streets, the owner of the shores, of government buildings, of state schools, of state hospitals, or the borders themselves. Somebody, though, must own them, because where there has been use of a resource, there is a legitimate owner of that resource. Now, due to the difficulties of tracing the real owners of these pieces of land, or these buildings, we may say that they are either unowned, or we may say that they are owned by the public from which they were seized. To most sensible people, the latter is obviously preferable. Many libertarians do suffer from the illusion that state property is unowned. I.e. that there exists no one with a claim to a given resource currently controlled by the state. Public property is not, though, yet to be homesteaded. It has been used for years, and it is clear from whom the state has confiscated the property, and it is equally as clear from whom the state has not confiscated the property. In addition to the expropriation of land itself, taxation pays for its upkeep. May we not say that those who have been taxed have a claim to public property? Or does the payment of taxation signify absolutely nothing? It is much better to think of public property as that of a criminal's property rather than of virgin land that humans are yet to discover. Indeed, to resolve this misunderstanding, I can do no better than quote Hans Hermann Hopper. Quote, "This analogy between public property and unowned resources is mistaken. There exists a categorical difference between unowned resources, open frontier, and public property. Public property is the result of state government confiscations, of legislative expropriations and or taxation, of originally privately owned property. While the state does not recognise anyone as its private owner, all of government-controlled public property has, in fact, been brought about by the taxpaying members of the domestic public. Austrians, Swiss, and Italians, in accordance with the amount of taxes paid by each citizen, have funded the Austrian, Swiss, and Italian public property. Hence, they must be considered its legitimate owners. Foreigners have not been subject to domestic taxation and expropriation. Hence, they cannot be assumed to have any rights regarding Austrian, Swiss, or Italian public property." End quote. It would be wrong, though, to characterise mass immigration as simply an innocent misunderstanding over precisely who owns what. It comprises a plan of the ruling class to balkanise the people, that is, to ensure that they are successfully turned against each other, women against men, blacks against whites, gays versus Christians, ad infinitum. Balkanisation is the word used by Sean Gabb. Gabb says that, quote, "They," the state and its agents, "wish to balkanise England into groupings more suspicious of each other than willing to combine against the ruling class. State-sponsored mass immigration has been the most obvious evidence of this desire, filling the country with people of different colours and with different ways, who do not like each other and who do not like and are not liked by the natives, is ideal balkanisation." End quote. This idea also features in Hopper's works, though he uses the term atomisation to describe the weakening of the people against the state. Hopper writes that, quote, "Forced integration is a means of breaking up all intermediate social institutions and hierarchies in between the state and the individual, such as the family, clan, tribe, community and church, and their internal layers and ranks of authority. In so doing, the individual is isolated, atomised, and its power of resistance vis-à-vis the state weakened." End quote. It is not statist or fascist to make the point that some peoples are obviously less likely to cohabit with certain other peoples. Yes, differences between nationalities and cultures do exist, and libertarians all too often ignore this fact. Accepting this does not weaken our argument in the slightest. Although this is what the modal libertarian, to use Rothbard's term, would have us believe. No, it's only by applying our philosophy to the real world that we will ever make progress. To acknowledge that a state exists and that there is a need for a policy on borders is not to devalue libertarianism, but rather to present a problem which libertarianism can then try to solve. Furthermore, the argument is often made that we are a nation of immigrants, and that throughout history, immigrants have come here to live to work and to settle. However, there are problems with this argument. The most obvious issue is that we are not still talking about the settlement of a small number of Irish people, but we're talking about an unprecedented flow of people from all over the world. And though our supposed aim, as libertarians, is to loosen state controls, it should also be a priority to ensure that whole areas of the country don't fall into the hands of those who wish to disintegrate our ways. As we live in the reality of a stated world, it is incredibly difficult to realise the goal of liberty simply by sitting back and doing nothing. The goal of libertarianism is not just to maximise freedom, as we must then ask, whose freedom? And why and when do we want to grant such freedom? It would surely maximise the freedom of a criminal if he wasn't brought to justice. It would surely maximise the freedom of a businessman if he was granted immunity from the law while his competitors were not. The complex issue of immigration is rather similar to that of whether or not we should, as libertarians, regulate a state monopoly, like the Royal Mail before it was privatised, or, in America, Post Office. If we allow the company, which has a state-enforced monopoly, to charge whatever prices it wants for stamps or for mail delivery, then it will certainly make more profits and it will certainly be much freer to do what it wants. However, this is clearly not the libertarian solution. The libertarian solution is to remove the state entirely from the area of mail delivery and to rid the market of artificial monopoly and not to merely allow the current monopoly to usurp its power even more. But if that can't be done immediately, then we must not settle for a policy which will sanction even more aggression, i.e. allowing the monopoly to increase its profits. We can think of this as a trade-off between two evils. Either we continue to regulate the state monopoly, or we allow it more liberty to charge higher prices on the exploited customers. And I know which I prefer of the two policies. So how does this apply to the immigration debate? Well, again, ideally, the solution is to remove the state completely and to allow immigration to be dealt with by the tiny decision-making units known as individuals. But while this is not an option, there must surely be a policy which will not merely maximise freedom, but which will reduce the scale of the violations of the private property rights of the public to public property. It is particularly important not to see and treat the country in which we live as if it were already a stateless society. It is not. There exist many questions which we as anarchists or libertarians wish we didn't have to answer. For as long as the state curriculum exists, while ultimately advocating its abolition, the anarchist will still have to consider its content. For example, though we might not like the idea of national compulsory education and a national curriculum, we can still suggest that certain things are taught to children, like mathematics and like logic, and that certain other things, like advanced voodoo, or not. I think this is basically what Murray Rothbard is getting at when he says, quote, "The libertarian, especially of the anarcho-capitalist wing, asserts that it makes no difference where the boundaries are, since, in a perfect world, all institutions and land areas would be private and there would be no national boundaries." Fine. But in the meantime, in the real world, in what language should the government courts hold their proceedings? What should be the language of the signs on government streets? Or the language of government schools? In the real world, national self-determination is a vitally important matter in which libertarians should properly take sides. End quote. There are, broadly speaking, two ways in which immigration policies have been observed to have worked throughout history. One policy is that of the monarchy, and the other is that of the present-day democratic egalitarian states. In a monarchy, the king or queen acted as if he or she owned the country and would therefore act in order to maximise property values. In a democracy, the ruler is only in an interim position, that is, he is only the caretaker of the country, and so he has little concern for the long-term prosperity of the country, as can be seen in the reckless actions of central bankers, who are all too happy to induce a credit-fueled boom which will end in a bust. The sort of immigration policy which a monarch would set is likely to be one of strict discrimination against anyone who might lower the value of his property. Whereas conversely, a democratic ruler is more likely to want uneducated bums to settle in the country, as they are more likely to support his egalitarian measures. It could be said that a monarchy attempts to emulate how private property owners would exercise their rights to association in order to maximise wealth and reduce the probability that people will come into conflict with one another. Monarchies were certainly not egalitarian, nor coincidentally did monarchies care about political correctness. Anti-discrimination laws and mass immigration alike did seldom feature in a monarchy. I am very happy to say that I support a very anti-democracy and unmajoritarian solution to the problem of immigration. A swift programme of secession, decentralisation and devolution to the point where only tiny decision-making units remain that can then decide who may or may not enter their village, hamlet or cul-de-sac. This will allow private property rights to one day be easily assigned to public property, which will finally get to the nub of the issue. As De Soto writes, quote, conflicts will be minimised precisely to the extent that private property rights became effective and were extended to include resources at present considered to be publicly owned. Until total privatisation can take place, the use of public goods must be regulated, end quote. And so, until the day when the amount of public property that exists is negligible, the state should regulate the use of them, rather like the state regulates the activities of state-enforced monopolies like the police, instead of letting them do as they please. As Hopper says, these regulations relating to immigration would take the following form. Quote, distinguishing strictly between citizens, naturalised immigrants, and resident aliens, and excluding the latter from all welfare entitlements. It means requiring as necessary for resident alien status as well as for citizenship, the personal sponsorship by a resident citizen and his assumption of liability for all property damage caused by the immigrant. It implies requiring an existing employment contract with a resident citizen. Moreover, for both categories, but especially for that of citizenship, it implies that all immigrants must demonstrate through tests not only English language proficiency, but also all-round superior above-average intellectual performance and character structure, as well as a compatible system of values, with the predictable result of a systematic pro-European immigration bias. End quote. Thus, immigration in the modern sense amounts merely to mass subsidised trespass. This is ultimately because the state is making decisions on behalf of the real owners of public property, and is doing so in the most imperfect way possible. A less imperfect way of making such decisions, if immigration must be dealt with at the national level, would be to discriminate in favour of immigrants who will be likely to contribute something valuable to British society. An even better compromise would be to decentralise immigration policy to as local a level as possible, so that decisions are taken by those who will be directly affected. The ultimate solution is a society where all decisions on migration are made on the basis of respect for private property rights, and thus where no trespass of any kind is allowed, promoted, or subsidised. However, Murray Rothbard was definitely correct when he said that, quote, apparently many libertarians aggressively overlook the obvious, end quote.